Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Professor J.C.D. Clark. Professor Clark's a well-established, hugely significant historian of the long 18th century, and today we're going to be talking to Professor Clark about one of his most recent projects, a new book on Thomas Paine, Britain, America, and France in the Age of Enlightenment and Revolution, recently published by Oxford University Press. Professor Clark, thank you for your time and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much and good morning to you.
Before we begin talking about the book itself, could you give us something of a retrospective on your many achievements to date?
Well, as an historian, I was educated at Cambridge, and I think in retrospect I was very lucky to be around when a generation of great scholars were still in post and I could learn from them. And I began as someone who was very interested in politics and also came to appreciate the significance of the history of political thought and also of religion. From there, I went to Oxford. I published on what I've called the long 18th century in the British Isles, that is between the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 and the Great Reform Act of 1832. I include the American Revolution as an Anglophone event. I'm interested also in the French Revolution. And the significance of that period, I think, is that it's crucial for the late 20th century account of modernization. I was taught that theory, as we all were. Gradually over time, I came to doubt it. And my work explores a number of ways of questioning the validity of that categorization, modernity.
Now, one of the things that we've learned from your work over the years and these many very distinguished contributions, Revolution and Rebellion, English Society, 1688 to 1832, Language of Liberty, From Reformation to Reform, which is a book that we use a lot in teaching in Belfast. One of the things we've learned is that we can't take any of our assumptions for granted until we've read your comments about them. That's true also of the subject of this book, Thomas Paine, isn't it? Who was Paine and why does he matter in the world today?
I suggest he matters because Paine was England's greatest revolutionary. No other leading revolutionary figure, I think, in the whole of English history was at the centre of events, great events, as Paine was so often. No other leader in the revolutionary cause was an author of books which sold so widely and had such an impact in their day. Paine is also important, I would suggest, because he's been overlaid by a series of explanations as people have recruited him retrospectively to justify their own causes. And what I want to do is to, rather like cleaning an 18th century portrait, to remove layers of varnish, so that we can get back to the man himself in his age, distinguishing that from the later uses to which he was put.
Now, in the book that you've shared with us, Paine is still, I was going to say a radical, that's a question you've termed. He's still an extremely important political figure, but he exists in a different way. He makes a different kind of contribution, doesn't he, to the kinds of things that we have taken for granted up to this point so often.
He does, and the most general way of explaining that, I think, is to say that Paine, like other famous revolutionary figures, is much more the sort of person who can speak to the general preoccupations of his age, rather than being an original figure who maps out the future course of development. And I think we still exist in the present day with a series of what I call heroic assumptions about authors in the history of political thought and also about political activists. I have come to question that, and I don't wish to diminish Paine's importance or to disparage him, but I want to emphasize and to raise up the importance of those thousands of activists and authors who were writing and doing things during Paine's lifetime. He contributed to a debate much more than he framed its terms.
So we read your book, and it's a very formidable book. How many words is it actually?
That's a very good question. Give me notice of that question. I can look it up. Far too many is the answer, I'm sorry to say.
Almost 500 pages of you know, characteristically densely argued and wisely reflecting material. But having read your book, how should we see Paine interacting in the world in which he lives?
As, I think, a catalyst very often, a trigger of things which had the potential to happen, rather than as an original thinker.
Now, your book is organised in parts as well as chapters. The first part focuses upon discourses and contexts. What are some of the most important discourses in this period, and how should we see Paine fitting into these?
Well, the first part of my book tries to outline some of the discourses in which he did not fit. For example, he was not a champion of the working class. He was not a champion of anti-slavery. He was not a champion of women's rights. He was much more a figure from a small town in England in the early 18th century. And the discourses to which he did subscribe had a lot to do with popular participation in politics, but very, very little to do with what we call democracy. He talked about rights, but he didn't talk the language of universal human rights that we've come to recognize from the 1970s. Instead, he was preoccupied by two things, which I think we've now largely forgotten. One is the significance of what I call the dynastic idiom in the 18th century. Paine was an enemy of monarchs and of aristocrats on the same basis. And we have to understand that to understand the significance of his enormous impact. But we must also understand that he is bypassed. Nobody now spends their time denouncing Queen Elizabeth II, at least not in England. They are locked in conflict over other matters. And secondly, the second discourse in which Paine is keenly involved and in which he is extremely well informed is the whole area of religion. And I want to argue that Paine's religion, he was a deist, was extremely important to him, rather than any secular idea of progress or any secular idea of human rights.
Now, religion matters in terms of Paine's biography, doesn't it? You explained to us that his family connections include Quakerism as well as the Church of England. How does that parental influence impact upon his later thinking? Can we work this out?
To answer that question shortly, no. A lot about Paine's early life is obscure, and we are piecing together fragments. We do know that his family was Anglican, but his father was Quaker in his upbringing. We do know that Paine was married in the Church of England twice, so he must have been a communicant member of the Church of England. We know that he was a member of the vestry in Lewes in Sussex, and so clearly he was actively engaged with some of the religious issues of his day. We think there is some evidence, although it's not entirely reliable, that he was active in early Methodism. So Paine, we think, was engaged in a personal religious journey, which found expression ultimately in deism, on which he wrote an enormous amount. And to say that Paine is a deist is rather like saying, if you read the whole of Isaac Newton's works, you will think that, that Newton was a theologian who did a bit of physics on the side. Similarly, Paine goes on and on endlessly about the significance of revolution, and he did a bit of politics on the side.
Now, you mentioned politics there, and another aspect of the discursive world into which Paine is born is Jacobitism. Can we work out how that influences his thinking about the issues that he's concentrating on?
Paine, I emphasise, was not a Jacobite. He was the opposite. He was an anti-Jacobite. But just as in the 1950s, it used to be said that people who were cold warriors, who were bitterly anti-communist, actually had the pattern of their thought dictated to them by their opponents. So also I think it was true of Paine and, and of many of his contemporaries that they talked about politics in a dynastic idiom, because monarchs symbolized a whole series of policy choices, and monarchs were symbolized by vast areas of theory. They were supported and explained to their subjects through large bodies of theory. So that Paine, when he disparages George III, goes on into the 1790s, calling George III the Elector of Hanover, which is exactly what the Jacobites used to call him. It doesn't mean that Paine was a Jacobite, but what it does mean is that Paine was preoccupied with the theme of monarchy, which is extremely important in his day, all the way through the American Revolution, all the way through the French Revolution, and his own attitudes to that central institution were can only be understood, I suggest, in relation to the leading preoccupations of a society. Can I make one more point on that issue? For most of the 20th century, historians supposed that the English Marxist historians supposed that what they called the English Revolution of the 1640s was much, much, much more important than the Revolution of 1688. Now that balance has changed. And for people in the 18th century, 1642 was surprisingly unimportant in the long retrospect. 1688, by contrast, triggered rebellion, war, European war, and division within society, which lasted for a very long time. This was the world in which Paine grew up, not the world of 1642.
One of the things that I found most intriguing about this part of your discussion was your emphasis that the world of early Methodism, like the associated worlds of early 18th century dissent or mid 18th century dissent, were often driven by certain kinds of political scepticism. And I should have known this, but I had never realised that the Countess of Huntington was a Jacobite, that early supporter of Calvinistic Methodism.
She was in it up to her neck, and her husband even more so. So that, for example, when John Wesley preaches his famous sermon in Oxford in 1744, which denounces the Hanoverian church and state, it is in effect his rising of 1745, he has to leave Oxford. The Countess of Huntington advises him to go north to Newcastle. Newcastle, why Newcastle is known to be full of Jacobite sympathizers. And he is there on the spot when Charles Edward lands in 1745. John Wesley has by that stage formally renounced Jacobitism. But it is all around him. The people he was brought up among, his family, his early contacts at Oxford, his religious associates, shared an attitude to the society in which they lived. They thought that it wasn't just wrong in this or that minor respect. He didn't identify particular faults that he could put right with a reform act of this kind or that kind. His attitude, as was the attitude of George Whitefield, was that the whole of society was rotten. Fish stinks from the head down, as the Chinese, I believe, say. And they pointed to the Hanoverian monarchs on the throne as the origin of the profound corruption of their society. And it's this rejection of society across the board that has both a religious and a dynastic dimension.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, this theme fits into one of the themes that runs through much of your writing, which is about the political meaning of religion in this period, especially, I suppose, from the perspective of the Thomas Paine book, The Political Meaning of Dissent. You have a wonderful line in the book where you describe Paine stumbling by accident into the American Revolution and discovering that America, in inverted commas, has in some senses been formed by the revivalistic preaching of people like George Whitefield.
Yes.
What is Paine's role in the American Revolution as you describe it in this book?
Paine shuts his eyes to the religious composition of the 13 colonies. That's very surprising in a way. But what he's doing is to try to find a common denominator of discourse that can be agreed to by all the different denominations in America. And what he finds there is a receptive audience for his deism. Because deism is an international movement. It is present in England, primarily in the Church of England. It's present also in the American colonies, especially among the elite. And Paine can say things about monarchy and about churches, especially the Church of England, which resonate with colonial Protestant nonconformists and which resonate with colonial American deists. He is a brilliant journalist who can express what people think, but also find common ground, or apparently find common ground, on which they can unite.
Now, as you worked through the religious aspect of the American Revolution, did you find that it confirmed the leading arguments of The Language of Liberty, your earlier book on this subject?
I think it did, but I would also add, well, I want to add to The Language of Liberty more about the common denominator that Paine's deism provided. He couldn't really go public on that because in a land of Orthodox Trinitarian believers, deism is still, before the American Revolution, a very hot topic. You tended to keep it quiet if you were a deist, or if you didn't keep it quiet, you paid quite a high price for coming up with your beliefs. So Paine was not a campaigner for deism during the American Revolution, but he did find ways of mobilizing American opinion in the direction in which it was going. And the direction in which it was going was primarily dictated by its Protestant nonconformist heritage. In our own day, we have seen the rise of radical Islam reveal the United States in ways that it's not willing to admit to itself as the land that the Protestant dissenters made. And if you stand outside the United States today, it is becoming more and more obvious that the Protestant dissenting inheritance is of profound importance to the present day. It was of even more importance in the 1770s.
Now, in political terms, Paine's interaction with American dissent, in inverted commas, or American low church Protestantism, was not really framed in terms of Presbyterian resistance theory, which is, you tell us, was you know, circulating widely within that particular part of the colonies. So how does his deism interact with what we might think of as being the much more finely tuned, intellectually serious tradition of politicized religious dissent that already exists in the colonies?
He didn't. He didn't engage with that. Remember, he's an Anglican, and he's not learned in Protestant nonconformist resistance theory. Indeed, if he were to have been, then his impact would have been geographically much more confined in the American colonies. What he is appealing to is driven by deism, in that he is arguing, what he believes is that people do not need churches to approach God, that they have an immediate access to God. And without churches as necessary ratifiers of political authority, it follows also that individuals have a license to act as free agents in any way they like. Paine is not a Democrat because he believes in universal manhood suffrage, still less universal suffrage. Paine is a populist because he believes that everybody is equidistant from God and that there are no institutions which, as he will put it, stand between the individual and God.
Now, there's a second revolution that Paine finds himself involved in, another unexpected revolution, this one occurring in France. In some ways, many ways, much more horrific than anything that happens in North America. How does your reconstruction of Paine's life show him interacting with that context?
It shows him knowing much less about the French Revolution than we used to think was the case, just as I've argued that Paine knew much less about the American Revolution than we thought, and was partly out of his depth in trying to act as a politician in the 13 colonies, or really in Pennsylvania. So he was even more out of his depth when he went to France and found that far from having a unique insight into the nature and causes of the French Revolution, he was at sea and had to try to ride a wave and to survive when the wave broke.
It's quite a radical, to use that unfortunate term, reconstruction of Paine's life, isn't it? It presses us to rethink a lot of the assumptions that we have taken for granted so often up to this point.
Including, if I might interrupt you there, including the assumption that revolutions have central or intrinsic meanings. And if we do assume that, then we naturally reach for eloquent and high-profile authors to give us shortcuts to those essential meanings. Now, I'm challenging that notion. I don't think that is a tenable position. Certainly, it can't be said of the French Revolution that Paine's Rights of Man, when it was translated into French, had a significant impact. There are other scholars, Trish Loughran is an important one, who have argued that the circulation of Paine's common sense in colonial America was much, much less than his admirers in the early 20th century had assumed. And I, too, want to scale down Paine's significance in the American Revolution, not to dismiss it entirely. He did have a role, indeed an important role, but I don't think it was the role of a framer of new ideas. It was rather the role of a catalyst. In the French Revolution, he didn't play the part of a catalyst. France is a society of 26, 28 million intelligent, literate people who are preoccupied with French affairs. The American Revolution was very French. I believe we're seeing scholars now admit that the American Revolution was very American or Anglo-American. And that moves us away from the old assumption, which came out of the Second World War, that the American Revolution was the first act and the French Revolution was the second act of a common drama. We're now seeing the American Revolution as an American or Anglo-American event, the French Revolution as a French event, and they become much more paradoxical, much more catastrophic, much more violent than we used to think.
So really, I suppose one of the big cumulative effects of your work over this series of books that we've mentioned, but especially in the Thomas Paine book that we're talking about principally today, is to make us think that these issues are important, but in different ways, that Paine is a crucial figure, but in a different way than the ways that we have thought up to this point.
Yes, that's exactly true.
What do you think, or what do you hope will be the legacy of the Thomas Paine book? How do you think, or how do you hope it will impact upon future scholarship in this field?
Principally, I hope, by engaging with what has been a leading preoccupation in Western countries since the 1970s, and that is the extraordinary explosion of natural rights theory. It is everywhere these days. Every group which wants to make a claim in the public arena does so by appealing to natural rights. And historiography has been created, a genealogy, if you like, which stretches back to the 18th century and to the American and French revolutions and builds on those two events the authority of universal human rights in the present world. I want to suggest that universal human rights in the present world is not very good at delivering good things to suffering humanity. In fact, it is in retreat everywhere. And one reason for that is that it has been falsely diagnosed, its historical origins have been misunderstood, and we need to revert to Thomas Paine for a better understanding, both of how revolutions happen and also of how good things in the public arena are delivered to the populations of Western states. That is rather an ambition, as you can see. But I believe that the tide of discussion is moving in that direction, not because I said so, but because natural rights theory, the theory of universal human rights, is failing to deliver on its promise.
Well, Professor Clark, we've taken up a great deal of your time this morning and we've enjoyed the discussion enormously. But before we wind up, could you tell us what you're working on at the moment?
Yes, it's a book on the Enlightenment. Indeed, it's the book that I was writing when an invitation to write a 6,000-word essay on Thomas Paine intruded on me. And I accepted the invitation to write a 6,000-word essay, which was indeed published in the Yale edition of Thomas Paine's collected works. I accepted that invitation because I thought it would be easy to do. I thought I knew all about Paine. I'd read him for years. I'd taught him for years. I've written a few pages on him. I thought it would be easy to write a 6,000-word interpretive essay. I found the opposite was true. The more I read of Paine and his contemporaries, the more I realized I had not understood him. He was much more interesting and much more important than I had ever thought. But now I get back to the book on the Enlightenment.
Some of us thought you didn't believe in the Enlightenment, Professor Clark.
Well, not at all. I'm on the side of the angels, as you know, and all matters. But this book will show why the Enlightenment is a term of historiographical art which was invented much later than we thought, and why in the long 18th century there wasn't one interesting and important thing going on organized by the notion of the Enlightenment. Instead, there were many interesting and important things, And we need to pay more attention, more sympathetic and scholarly attention to those many important things than we have done hitherto.
Well, Professor Clark, thank you so much for coming on to the programme today to talk about this new book, Thomas Paine, Britain, America and France in the Age of Enlightenment and Revolution, just published by Oxford University Press. And thank you so much for sharing news of your next project on the Enlightenment itself. We look forward to seeing that when it comes out. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your invitation.
And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.